eerie house, under the scrutiny of the balding old man and the room full of guards. "You know who I am," Dan said, standing before the wheelchair. "Who are you?" Don Marcello waggled a fat, beringed finger.
"That is not important," he said in heavily accented English.
Dan noticed that his rings dug deeply into the flesh of his fingers. The old man had been wearing them for many years.
"We were supposed to see Mrs. Scanwell," said Malik, standing beside Dan. "Where is she?"
"You will see her," Don Marcello replied. "Mr. Randolph will not."
A bolt of fear sizzled through Dan. I should have known better. They're too smart to take me to the same place they've taken her. "Then it's no deal," he said sharply. "If I don't see her with my own eyes, the deal is off." Don Marcello's mouth dropped open for a moment. Then he threw his head back and laughed. Laughed so hard his eyes squeezed shut and tears ran down his baggy cheeks. Laughed until he began coughing and sputtering. One of the silent men standing in the shadows behind the wheelchair came up and handed him an inhalator. Hacking and coughing, the old man stuck the nozzle in his mouth and pressed the plastic plunger. Maybe he'll choke to death, Dan thought.
"They didn't tell me you were a comedian," said Don Marcello, once he got his breath under control again.
"The deal was that I see Mrs. Scanwell and make certain that she's safely on her way back to Paris," Dan insisted.
"You're in no position to make any demands," Don Marcello replied, pointing to Malik. "This one will see the woman and take her back to Paris. You stay here."
"No," said Malik.
"What?"
It seemed to be a word that Don Marcello did not often hear.
"We have honored our commitment. You must honor yours. Randolph is entitled to see Mrs. Scanwell. You pledged that he would. You must honor that pledge."
"Honor? You talk to me about honor?"
Malik leaned down slightly to put his face closer to the old man's.
"You cannot keep the woman silent if she fears that Randolph has been murdered. Unless she sees him, she will not cooperate with you."
Don Marcello glared up at him. Malik turned to Gaetano.
"You know Jane, Raffaello. Am I speaking the truth about her?"
"Yes," said Gaetano reluctantly.
"She is in love with Randolph. If she thinks we've killed him, well, we'll have to kill her, too."
"So?"
"And you will have to kill me also," Malik said. "I will not stand idly by if you murder Jane Scanwell."
Dan's eyes flicked from one of them to the other as he thought, "Malik doesn't mind them knocking me off, but he's sticking his neck out for Jane."
"How will the world react to the death of two members of the Global Economic Council?" Malik asked. "One of them, its new chairman."
Gaetano shifted uneasily on his feet. Don Marcello stared at Malik, one hand stroking his chins.
"There are limits to what you can get away with," Malik went on. "Murdering two GEC representatives will bring down the full power of the international community upon your heads, and you know it."
Dan was silently urging, "Don't tell him we're being tracked, for Christ's sakes. Don't blow it." Don Marcello finally replied,
"You will cooperate with us if we satisfy the woman?"
With a glance at Dan, Malik allowed a tiny smile to creep across his lips.
"Naturally. What do I care if you kill this American? He's been nothing but a thorn in my flesh for years. But Jane Scanwell is another matter. Let her see Randolph. Then I will take her back to Paris. What happens to this Yankee afterward is of no concern to me."
"He sounds as if he means it," Dan thought. Aloud, he said, "Jane won't go along with you if she realizes I'm dead."
"She will not realize it," Gaetano said. "We will make a few tapes of your voice and then use a synthesizer to send her telephone messages every few weeks.
You'll need my cooperation to make those tapes." Gaetano snickered.
"You'll cooperate. First, you will scream a lot, but soon enough you'll do whatever we tell you to."
40. The wall of water that drowned Biloxi hit the inlet to Lake Pontchartrain less than half an hour later. It surged through the inlet, steepening and speeding up in its narrow confines, smashing everything in its path, boats, wharves, locks, bridges, and surged into the broad lake like an invading army searching for plunder. The concrete bridge carrying Interstate Highway 10 was inundated. Cars, trucks, buses swept away into the churning muddy waters. The central span of the bridge collapsed, never designed to stand up to latitudinal stresses of such force. Within minutes, the expanding wave surged over the north-south causeway that spanned the lake and smashed against the concrete levee that protected the city of New Orleans and its suburban communities. Whole sections of the levee were gouged away. Rotting concrete and rusting steel reinforcements that should have been replaced years earlier simply tore loose under the tidal wave's enormous pressure. Millions of tons of water poured through. The city's pumping stations were overwhelmed before they could even start up. A frothing, smashing wave of dirty gray water rushed through the streets, knocking down poles and highway bridges, collapsing buildings, tossing automobiles and diesel trucks and city buses like flotsam. Over the unstoppable roar of the water came the screams of a million people and more as they were drowned or crushed by the raging water. Downhill toward the river, the water raced, carrying half the city with it. Electrical wires snapped and fizzed. Sewer lines literally exploded with overpressure. Basin Street, Rampart Street, Bourbon Street disappeared beneath the raging floodwaters. At Duncan Plaza, the water smashed through the doors and windows of the City Hall and other government buildings in an unstoppable torrent, tearing away desks, file cabinets, bookcases, people. The mayor found herself stranded on the roof of the City Hall, clinging to a useless radio antenna. She sobbed hysterically as she looked out on what had been a city. There was nothing to see except the ghosts of buildings sticking out of the surging, filthy water. The water itself was thick with debris and the floating bodies of the dead. The same twin-engine floatplane took Dan, Malik, and Gaetano westward through the late afternoon toward Sardinia. They were totally unaware of the disaster that had struck the Gulf Shore and New Orleans. Dan leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes. That old man is the boss of these hoodlums, whoever he is. Then Dan grinned sardonically. They were bargaining over my life, Malik and the old man, deciding when they would kill me. Not if, when. He wondered where the Yamagata plane was. They can't have stayed aloft all this time. They must have had to put down somewhere and refuel. Have they picked us up again? Inadvertently, he reached toward his ear, where the biochip transceiver was lodged, but pulled his hand away when he remembered that Gaetano was sitting behind him. They haven't detected it so far, he thought, but if I activate it now to give Nobo's people a signal to home on, would the pilots up in the cockpit be able to detect it on their instruments? He glanced over at Malik, sitting tensely in his seat. Not yet, Dan decided. The plan is that we don't activate the chips until we see Jane. Then the Yamagata team can attack, if they're still close enough to get the signal. No matter what happened, Jane would be safe. Malik's playing a dangerous game, tightrope walking between Gaetano and his own interests. But he wants Jane safe almost as much as I do. At least he says he does. Dan tried to sleep. But no matter how exhausted he felt, no matter how weak and old he felt, sleep would not come. I'm scared, he realized. For the first time in my life, I'm really scared. These guys are going to kill me. Or try to. I'll be okay once the action starts, he told himself. It's this damned waiting. Just sitting here with nothing to do but think and wait and worry. Eventually, he drifted into a troubled sleep, dreaming of formless monsters and hovering faces that shifted before he could truly recognize who they were. As they drove slowly up the switchback road cut into the cliff's face, Dan craned his neck for a view of the castle. It loomed up at the top of the cliff, dark gray crenellated stone walls outlined against the bright blue Sardinian sky. It's not all that big, Dan thought, but those walls look plenty thick. He felt sick in the pit of his stomach. Whether from fear or radiation, or just the fact that he had not eaten anything in almost a full day, he could not tell. Maybe they plan to starve me to death, he thought. Didn't one of the Roman